Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. This is episode number 38. My name is Karen, and I am joined by Kristen.
Hello, people. How's it going? Faux perkiness today.
Faux perkiness.
I'm trying to not be asleep still.
Yeah.
I'm really trying hard.
I don't think I got a lot of sleep last night, and there was construction right outside my window.
They've torn up the entire road.
Yeah, it's very rude, and they should not work until 10 a.m.
I mean,
8 a.m. is too early.
I agree.
I do not appreciate it. Please halt everything while I sleep.
I mean, that's all we're asking.
Right? That's not too much.
Nope.
You can contact us at Prophecy Podcast on Twitter, at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Tumblr, Instagram, and Facebook, and Prophecy Radio Podcast at gmail.com. Today, we are going to be talking about Hellhounds. I'm actually really excited about this because it did not go in the direction that I thought it would.
Mm.
So, I feel like I have some interesting things to share with you today, which I'm very excited about.
Yeah, I'm likewise interested.
But first, we are going to get into our news and updates. Like always, we got like a good blend of stuff this week. And also, Rick dropped a blog earlier in the week instead of like the day we decided to record. So
thanks.
Yeah, this really worked out for us. Appreciate that. First, though, I want to say that Yoon-Ha Lee's Nine Fox Gambit, which is his like one of his older series, is getting turned into a TRPG / TTRPG. And I had to Google this. I thought I knew what it meant, but TTRPG is tabletop role-playing game, and the other one is like tactical role-playing game. And I'm pretty sure this is going to be a tabletop game, although the company that is, like, producing it also makes, like, video games. I mean, if this got turned into a video game, like, I would 100% play it. Although, what do they call that? Like, turn-based games? Not, like, 100% my thing, but just because it's Yoon-Ha Lee, like, I would totally play it. Yeah. But it's from Android Press, and they said, huge announcement coming in 2023 from Android Press, the official Nine Fox Gambit TRPG based on the Nebula and Hugo Award-nominated space opera by New York Times bestselling author Yoon-Ha Lee. Oh, I thought there was going to be more to that sentence. That was the end of the sentence.
Done. Okay.
Yeah. Gosh, I would love to have all of those things in front of my name at some point. Wouldn't that be awesome?
Yes.
Yeah. But this is really exciting, and Yoon is writing it himself. I've noticed he's such a talented person. He's like an illustrator, kind of like he does, you know, drawings and stuff like that. Obviously a writer, into gaming. Excellent taste in cats, so I feel like this is not a surprise that he's involved with the process here.
No, that's very cool.
Yeah, it is. It is pretty exciting. Then we got a couple of Reed Riordan articles, and Reed Riordan has been all over the place lately. That is not a criticism, but just because last week their queer article got taken down, and as far as I can see, that it has not gone back up, so I don't know if they're still working on it or what. We're running out of time, though, everyone. Like, it's getting to be the end of June, and I really want that to go back up with the correct language and everything. A lot of people have been doing artwork of, like, they had all the people lined up.
Yeah.
And they've been doing their own spin on that, and it's really gorgeous artwork. So, you know, hop on Instagram if you guys want to see some of that. I've been trying to put more artwork in our stories on Instagram so that people can kind of find new fan artists and stuff like that. So if you're into that, go follow us, and hopefully you can find some really cool things to look at. But so it kind of swung to the other end of the spectrum this week with Reed Riordan. First, though, they did put up an article about the Heytay, which is that, like, lion, like the unicorn lion, unihorn lion creature from The Last Fallen Moon. And it's a pretty cool looking creature. I really love the look of it.
Yeah. This artwork is very well done.
Yeah.
It's not what I pictured, but I don't know what I pictured.
Like, I think I pictured a little bit more of, like, a rainbowy kind of creature.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. And this is very, like, blue iridescent, sort of.
Well, and if I remember correctly, there, I don't know. It's like a lion creature, but I thought it had some dog in it, too. And I don't know. It, yeah. I remember the official, like, when we got the actual description of it, like, I remember trying to, like, piece together what that would look like in my brain. And it wasn't quite this, but I like this, too.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it looks really cool. So yeah. I'll link to that article in the show notes. You guys can check that out. But then, the bigger article this week was meeting Namjoon from The Last Fallen Moon, and this is an Imugi, I think is how you pronounce that. So, the article says, Namjoon is actually a half-snake, half-yang creature known as an Imugi. For those not in the know, Imugis are easily identifiable by their scaly skin, shark-like teeth, and forked tails as sharp as blades and coated with acid. So this is, like, a very scary creature. And if you
less cuddles, more
teeth. Yeah, more teeth.
Got it.
And if you've read The Last Fallen Moon, you'll know that these creatures are pretty intimidating. They're a little bit scary, and I always got worried whenever they showed up on the page. But the interesting thing about this article is that these creatures in Gracie Kim's book were named after the BTS members and named after Namjoon, aka RM. And when Rick put up this post, a little while later, all of a sudden, Meet Who was trending because he had tweeted, like, Meet Namjoon, and all these people were going, wait, Meet Who? And it was BTS fans, ARMY, tweeting about the fact that he was named after one of the BTS members, and it started trending worldwide.
Oh my goodness.
And if you know anything about BTS and their fans, it's that they will... They're actually a lot like Percy Jackson fans. We'll get stuff trending.
Mm-hmm.
So I even had one of my friends who loves BTS text me and be like, did you see this? And I was like, yes, oh my gosh. Like, I didn't realize that it would get trending on their side, too. So that was actually really exciting. And there was a lot of people looking at this article, a lot of people, you know, liking Rick's tweets and Gracie's tweets. And she was super excited because she likes BTS and... It was just really exciting, and I was so happy for her.
Oh, yeah.
And I meant to ask Courtney this, but for some reason, people were like, yeah, of course, like, you know, RM would have, like, dragon eyes or stuff like that. So there must be something with him and dragons, or, like, I meant to ask Courtney. I'll have to do that next time. But I thought it was really, really cute, and I liked that. Also, I just love the titles in this article, Forever Young. Pick of the litter, work your magic, you won't like me when I'm hangry.
Aww.
It's pretty great.
It is.
More exciting news, and this is one that I'm really, really into, is that Taylor K. Mejia, who is the author of the Paola Santiago books, is writing a new book, a middle grade contemporary horror novel called It Happened to Anna. And I'm going to share, like, the little... What does this usually come from? Like, Publishers Weekly, I think? They always have those blurbs.
The little snippets.
Yeah. So this says, Hannah Hill at Delacorte Press has bought, in a preempt, It Happened to Anna by Taylor K. Mejia, the Paola Santiago series, and a second standalone book. This middle-grade contemporary horror novel follows a girl who is being literally haunted by loneliness in the form of a vengeful ghost until a new friendship upends her life and threatens the ghost's hold over her. Publication is scheduled for summer 2024. I didn't see that before. That's so far away. And Jim McCarthy, I'm sorry, I don't care about you. Sorry, Jim. That's nothing. It's just about the world rights. I'm sure you're lovely. So, yes, middle grade contemporary horror novel. I love horror novels.
Yes, you do.
I love... Paola is a very dark world. I always think of, like, blacks and greens when I think about that. So... I think this fits her very well, and I am super excited.
Very cool. Very cool.
Yeah.
Happy for all the horror readers out there.
Yeah. Kristen's like, I am not, not one of them.
Me. Not me. No. I like things fluffy and romantic and a little spicy.
Yeah.
That, no horror, please.
See, it's funny because I've been reading more horror and more romance lately, so I'm just all over the place.
Yeah.
I contain multitudes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you, Rick, for posting a blog post earlier this week and not on the day that we decided to record. It'd be hilarious if you put up another blog post today.
Right now?
Yeah. Oops. I'm not going to say it's not going to happen, because last time we did that, it did happen. So, you know, we'll go with the flow. But he did put up a June 21st blog post with three new cast members. And because these are kids who haven't been in a whole ton of things, we decided to just include it in the news. And, you know, we'll continue on and every once in a while, I'm sure, as more people come out, maybe we'll do a whole episode on them. But it felt appropriate to kind of keep them to the news section this week.
Yeah, we still don't have any of the gods cast, so I'm sure they'll probably put those out in one big lump.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because, again, they're probably not really going to get into that till the later episodes, really. Right. Like, you'll get Poseidon early or whatever, but, you know. So, yeah, I'm sure once we get the gods, like, we could maybe do an episode on those.
Yeah. So, first up is Olivia Morton as Nancy Boba Fett, and Rick wrote, her hobbies include archery, biking, skating, and swimming. That last skill is especially important since she may be taking an unexpected swim as Nancy Boba Fett, Percy's nemesis at Yancey Academy. Which is hilarious because, yes, she is going to fall into the fountain, and it's going to be great. She has not been in a lot of stuff. She's been in two shorts, and Yet They Speak and Better Now. She's got bright red hair. She reminds me a little bit of Rachel, so I'm like a little bummed that she's not Rachel, but that's not till later anyway.
We've got a little time.
Yeah.
No, I think she'll be great, and it's a small role. It's not, you know, she's not gonna be around for a million episodes, but that's good if she's able to get something like this on her resume along with those shorts. Like, that's awesome.
Yeah, I think she's only going to be in episode one, so, you know, it's kind of an in-and-out situation, but
Nancy's not exactly a recurring character.
No.
She just kind of is there and is a, pain in the butt.
Yeah.
And then she, you know, then we move on. So, we are very excited for Olivia as Nancy. So
that this is going to be pretty cool. Then we have Dior Goodjohn as Clarice LaRue. Rick writes, Dior is a multi-talented actor, singer, songwriter, and dancer. At just 15 years old, she is no stranger to acting. And then, as Clarice LaRue, child of Aries, she is a strong-willed and competitive fighter who doesn't let much stand in the way of her winning. Intensely loyal to her close friends, she's also quite intimidating to newcomers. Look out, Percy! And Dior has been in Glee as Little Santana, which is probably what we would know her from.
Yeah.
She's also been in Raven's Home, Head of the Class, and Are You Afraid of the Dark? And, like, I've heard of those things, like, even though they're for younger kids. So she's been in some bigger stuff.
Yeah.
Well, and, of course, Raven's Home. So I feel like, man, already she's got some really good things on her resume.
Well, Head of the Class, if I'm not mistaken, I think the daughter from One Day at a Time, I'm pretty sure she was the lead on Head of the Class, if I'm not mistaken.
Do you remember her name? Isabella Gomez?
Yes, that's it.
That's
Yep, but, like, that's on HBO Max, and I never got a chance to watch it, but I was always really interested in it, so it does make me a little more interested in, like, maybe checking it out sometime in the next month and a half, 2 months, 6 months. We've got time. Just because I'd like to see Dior in something else, kind of get an idea of her, you know.
Right.
See her on screen, see what, you know, see what she's up to, that sort of thing. And yeah, there's definitely have seen her as, already seen her as Lil Santana, but I will probably never watch Are You Afraid of the Dark. So if I'm going to watch anything, it'll be Head of the Class.
That's true. Maybe I'll watch Are You Afraid of the Dark and we'll there compare notes.
I didn't watch it when I was a child, and I will not be watching it now.
I didn't watch anything scary as a child.
Nope.
So we had talked a little bit about how we wanted Clarice to be a bigger girl. Dior is not. It's fine. Like, I am a little disappointed just because I wanted some, like, you know, fat representation and stuff like that, but that's no mark against her ability to portray the character, because I think she will. And I really liked, she's apparently not great at Twitter, like she's getting used to Twitter, and she tweeted yesterday, "Okay, y'all, signing off so I can go get buff for you guys. Keep tagging me so we can chat after." And I was just like, okay, like she's gonna go get buff, she's gonna be Clarice. And I've seen like stills of her, and she looks like she has the attitude for a child of Aries. Like, she looks like she can be really tough. So I'm not worried about this at all. I'm really excited.
I second that. I'm not at all worried about her ability to beat Clarice. She's going to be great. I can already tell. Like, she's got that sass and that fire that Clarice kind of has always burning under the surface. And she's going to do great. But I'm also with you in that there's not a lot of opportunities for a plus size rep in this, like, especially in Lightning Thief. I mean, as we meet more and more of the campers, I guess there's always a chance that somebody could be a little differently mm-hmm. built than Rick initially described them. But Clarice is the one character that was described as being, like, solid and stocky and not necessarily, like, you know, grossly overweight, but she was just a bigger girl.
Yeah.
And I was looking forward to seeing that on screen, and that is a little bit of a disappointment, but has nothing to do with Dior. I am very, very excited to mm-hmm. see her bring this character to life. It's just one of those things that you kind of have to deal with and let it go.
I keep thinking about that image in the illustrated Lightning Thief where Clarice literally looks like an adult person against Percy. She is so big.
Yeah.
But, you know, whatever. Selena Beauregard, make her plus size.
Right.
Wouldn't that be awesome?
There are definitely
that would be so cool.
Other opportunities. Yeah. Yeah.
And that would be like child of Aphrodite. Like, I think that would send a really good message. So I guess we'll see. You know, it'll happen. But Becky also tweeted, "Having met Dior in person on set, I'm here to tell you that yes, she is gorgeous and stylish in her orange Camp Half-Blood t-shirt. And I say that especially for all the people afraid of the color orange as a fashion option." Which is really, before that, she said, "Checking Twitter trending, don't see Percy Jackson in entertainment, but instead see fashion and beauty trending Dior 39,700 tweets. This is one of those weird social media algorithms that makes me love Twitter today." Because her name's Dior, so, like, maybe Twitter didn't know where to put it.
Right, but exactly. It was like, wait, why is this? Yeah. Why is this a thing?
But people were very excited. I'm very excited. She is beautiful, and I just think that Clarice is one of those characters that I think we don't see a whole lot. We don't see, like, a young woman who's really tough and not very nice and not really be, like, she's an antagonist in the early books, but she's very much still a hero, and she's way more complex than I think a lot of other characters we see, so I'm so excited to see her come alive on screen.
Oh, yeah. Somebody on Twitter the other day said that out of all of the characters, especially from Lightning Thief, but from the Olympians, Clarice is the one that they think would make the best spinoff show.
Yeah.
Simply because there's so much that happens with Clarice and to Clarice behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. Like, almost all of Titan's Curse, we have no idea what's going on with Clarice, because we have no idea what's going on back at camp, and she's back at camp and all that. Mm-hmm. So, like, I thought about it and I was like, you know what? Like, that's totally true. I would love to watch a Clarice show. Like, mm-hmm. get an idea of who Clarice... I know we're already talking about spinoffs. The show's
not even out. No, but I was just thinking, like, the Clarice show in, like, 80s, like, font and stuff like that would be so funny.
Clarice explains it all?
That... There you go.
Boom! Not a lot of shows that have Clarissa or Clarice in the show. But yeah, no, I just think that would be a really cool possibility if they wanted to try and do spinoffs, or we know with, like, Star Wars, they're doing, like, 8 million shows right now. And so if Percy proves to be, you know, a really worthwhile adventure for them, 2 or 3 seasons down the line, maybe there's an opportunity for some of these characters to get
a limited series.
Stories.
Like,
like, just to kind of see what Clarice is up to in Titan's Curse. Like, mm-hmm. there's a lot that happens while we're off doing this other thing. So, like, a companion series, a limited series would be really cool.
You know what I don't think they do enough is you could have, like, special episodes. Like, Doctor Who has the Christmas episode every year and stuff like that. And it's, like, a standalone story that's almost like a movie in its own right. And I feel like they could do that for some of these characters, especially, like you said, later on, where she goes on the quest in the labyrinth, and we never see any of that, and she comes back changed. I would watch an entire episode about... I would watch several episodes about that, but, like, at least one episode.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's a really cool way to create fresh content, especially if filming each season is going to take a little bit longer because they're filming for so long for the first one. If we get a second one, it might be 2 years before we get the next season, which will be a little nuts, but, you know, I understand that's kind of how it works. To film something small in between to keep people interested.
Yeah.
Like, I think they're doing the Guardians of the Galaxy holiday special. Yeah, you know? Yeah. That would be awesome.
Yeah, it's a very British thing, because I'm pretty sure Downton Abbey has specials. Oh, like, I think some of the... I think they're included, they're folded into the seasons once they came out on DVD, and, you know. But I'm pretty sure some of those were holiday specials that...
Gotcha.
That's why the episodes are a little longer, because I think those are, like, 90 minutes usually or something. So, yeah, it's a very British thing to have these special episodes where, you know, you go on an extra adventure or whatever, and I definitely think that's something that we in the States should be adopting and being like, we need more specials. And
especially if you shoot shorter seasons, higher quality shows, and they take longer to come out. Like, I think people now are very accepting of that. Like, they really don't mind, because if it's a good show, they'll wait for it. How long have we been waiting for Stranger Things? Like, it's been a while.
Right.
And if they shoot... I mean, even Stranger Things could have done something like that, even if it was a flashback episode or, you know...
Stranger Things Christmas special.
Right! Oh my gosh.
Oh my god.
I would totally watch that. but I think that's an excellent idea, and I think you should do it, Disney.
Yeah, so just keep it, you know, something to consider in case you're listening.
Yes.
You are listening.
You are listening. Of course they listen to our podcast.
Of course.
Yeah.
One more thing about Dior. Someone pointed out that she is a bit... She could prove to be the Tom Holland of this cast, because she has not purposely done anything, but apparently she accidentally let slip another actor who's on the cast, and she addressed him by his character name. I am not going to say it because I don't want to cause any problems. It's a minor character.
Okay.
Minor-ish.
Yeah.
But they have a name, and, like, they're an actual character. So apparently she called this actor by his character name on Instagram, I believe, and everybody was like, oh, is that what that is? Like, it was really funny.
I think I saw that message pop up in the Discord for the other Percy Jackson podcast Discord, and I didn't actually go look at it yet, but now I'm kind of curious.
Well, and she's also the first cast member to really give us any pictures, and she took some pictures, not of the set, but of, like, the behind-the-scenes area at what will be Camp Half-Blood.
Out in the forest.
Yeah. And so I'm like, okay, alright. So Dior's the one we need to follow. Like, I kind of like it. I kind of like it. It's okay. I'm sure Disney will help her just like they helped Tom Holland.
Yeah.
They just won't tell her as much.
That boy is frightened now. He doesn't say anything.
He has had the fear of God put into him. He's terrified. Like, no. But yeah, I just thought it was really cute. I was like, okay, so she's the one that we need to keep an eye on because she's going to share stuff.
Yeah.
And that's good fun.
That's super cute. Last, we have Charlie Bushnell as Luke Castellan. Oh, I feel like Luke was one of the other really big ones I was waiting for. I mean, I was waiting for Clarice, too, but Luke is so pivotal. More so even than Clarice, like, he plays a bigger role. And actually, that's kind of one of the things that Rick says here. He goes, a Los Angeles native, Charlie Bushnell, had an epiphany in 2017 when his best friend, the family dog Petito, passed away. While binging Stranger Things to distract from the loss, he announced to his family, I can do that. And then Rick says, as Luke Castellan, head counselor of the Hermes Cabin, Luke will soon become one of the most influential people in Percy's life. And I like that he mentioned that, because really, everything that has happened to Percy since he arrived at Camp Half-Blood, since before he arrived at Camp Half-Blood, technically, has been because of Luke. I mean, and Kronos, but Luke has also been a driving force.
Yeah.
And really, it's true. Luke has had such a huge impact on Percy that it's very cool to see who has been cast in that role. Charlie has a very good look. He has kind of a sad, intense look to his eyes. He's been in a couple of shorts, and he's also been in Diary of a Future President, which I have also heard of but have never seen.
Right, yeah, I haven't watched that either. I have to say, when I first looked at him, he has, like, really good brow. He gives good brow.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
And for some reason, Luke is so broody.
Yeah.
That, like, I'm really glad they got somebody who has, like, good brow presence.
Yeah.
Because it's just one of those things when you're casting a character as complicated and interesting as Luke, you need somebody who can really give that to you on camera. Not just emotionally, but also, like, physically. And he has good brow, and it will be furrowed in anger and discontent. And I'm so excited. Not for Charles to be discontented, of course, because we are very happy that he is around.
Yes.
But, yeah, I'm definitely ecstatic to see him in this role. I really think he's going to do a great job. I know his name's kind of been floating around for a couple of days.
Yeah, we kind of had a feeling it was coming.
Just because, you know,
he followed everyone.
The internet sleuths, and we sleuth and find things out. And, yeah. But, no, I'm really, really excited. Mm-hmm. I think he's going to be a great Luke. Just the presence he seems to have and how he's reacted to the news. And it feels like he's just got his finger on exactly what this character is. Mm-hmm. And I loved the description here and how generic and basic it is to what Luke is. Like,
right.
Luke is so much, but they can't tell you any of it because for those that haven't read the books, they don't want to give anything away,
right.
And I don't blame them. But, like, reading that description, I was like, yeah, uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's soon, funny.
We'll soon become one of the most influential people, not in a good way.
Right.
Like, but, like, the people who haven't read the books have no idea. They're going to think he's great.
Right.
For, like, you know, 3/4, 90% of of the show, and then at the end it's going to be betrayal.
And then every season from then on will just be more and more betrayal.
Is it, one of the things I'm looking forward to most with Luke is the scar down the side of his face. Mm-hmm. I assume they're going to include that because it's kind of, not pivotal, but, you know, it's part of who he is.
It's a distinctive feature.
Yeah, and it kind of shows him as a demigod who has survived things, as a warrior, and I just love, like, prosthetic stuff, and I'm very excited for the scar down the side of his face.
Yeah, but no, very excited.
Yeah. Closing this out of Rick's blog post, he says, "All three of these young actors are doing an incredible job on set. We are lucky to have such talented and genuinely nice people to work with. It makes coming to work each day a pleasure." And I just thought that was nice.
That is very nice.
That made me happy.
Yeah.
Cool.
We love cool people, and these people seem pretty cool.
Yes. Can't wait for more. And he also did say, like, more soon at the end, so hopefully, you know, we keep getting blog posts. It's been, like, one a week lately, so.
I was gonna say, we casted 10 people when we did that episode. We now have 8 of them. Who are the two we're missing? It's
Medusa.
Oh, yeah.
And Charon.
Ah, good
Medusa and Charon.
Good job.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, there's also a couple of other smaller characters. Like, they could cast Argus because he could play a role here. Even though we don't really see him till one of the later books, like, he's around. Mm-hmm. He just doesn't factor in the story. So, since he's at camp, they could definitely include him. And as we said before, we still got all the gods to go to. So,
yeah.
There's still a lot to be announced.
Yes. I'm excited.
Oh, yeah.
You know what else I'm excited for?
Hellhounds?
I am. How did you know?
I
was such a good guess.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. I actually am really excited about Hellhounds because I sat down last night to put this episode together, and I was like, okay, this shouldn't be too hard. Like, Hellhounds, we kind of all know what they are. And I went to Percy Jackson's Greek Gods and Percy Jackson's Greek Heroes and looked up Hellhounds, and they weren't in the books. There were no hellhounds in those books. And I was like, what?
What
is going on?
What is this magic?
So I had to do a little sleuthing, and I learned a lot of stuff. And hopefully you will, too, and hopefully our listeners will, too.
Yeah.
So hellhounds, and maybe, like, everyone's like, we know this already. Well, for those of you, like me, who didn't, hopefully this is fun. Hellhound is a very, very, very general term. Like, it's used, and I think we kind of did already know that, it's used everywhere in a lot of different instances. They're dog-like creatures which appear in mythology all over the world. a lot of them share common traits. Like, they're usually black. They usually have black fur. They usually have red eyes. And they usually look like a large dog. Pretty basic in terms of, you know, that sort of thing. There are other ones in other mythologies and, like, folklore and legends that are different. There's one in a Welsh folktale, and Welsh is a very difficult language, but I'm hoping this is pronounced correctly. The Cún Annwn, which were pure white with red ears. Those were their hellhounds.
Wow.
Which I feel like is pretty interesting.
It's actually probably more accurate. White fire is hotter than, like, red or orange fire that we're used to seeing, and, like, blue is hotter than that. So, like, I could see it being, like, a white fiery thing with red ears, because the ears are cooler and the tail maybe is red. Mm-hmm. And, like, I can totally see that. Yeah. That would be very scary.
Just, you know, when you look at mythology, you can see a through line in a lot of them. And whenever anything is a little bit more of an outlier, that always makes me more interested. So I really kind of gravitated toward that one, which is pretty cool.
Also, I love that that has no vowels.
Right?
Well, it's, the A, I guess. But, like, there's really no vowels in the wording of that. And I'm like, oh, Welsh.
If you guys want to look it up, it's spelled C-W-N space A-N-N-W-N.
It's just very interesting. You don't, you know.
Yeah.
Vowels are important in English, and I don't know how to say words without them. So I think it's very cool.
Yeah. We have a friend who's Welsh, and I always used to love listening to her, like, say the town names and stuff, because they were a bit intense and not something that my mouth is used to pronouncing.
Exactly.
I really had to rein myself in this episode because I wanted to go through all the different legends of hellhounds, and I was like, no, you're supposed to be talking about Greek mythology. So there's a lot out there if you guys get interested in this.
I was going to say, I feel like we have to do a very brief mention that I loved the inclusion of hellhounds on Teen Wolf because it was a very different way it to was. Think about them and to think of them being like, you know, human creatures that, you know, a supernatural creature in a human body that has these properties of this creature that is in all the mythologies.
And he had fire, like, it was a very intense, it was a really cool.
I will say, that storyline in Teen Wolf was one of the ones I was most excited to see play out, just because it was so different and new weird.
Yeah.
So, love that. But yes, we are talking about Greek mythology here.
But some of the other ones, you know, they usually had, like, mangled or charred fur. Others could shapeshift, more sounding a little bit more like werewolves in some cases. Sometimes they can turn into other animals, too, like rabbits. Like, there were some really weird ones that were, like, you wouldn't expect it. Now, hellhounds were actually, like, despite the fact that they're hellhounds, could be kind of any sort of alignment, I guess is how I want to say that. Some were evil, and the ones that were evil typically had red eyes. Some were just plain old neutral, and others were actually benign and helpful to travelers, and they would, like, guide them to the right places. And the way you could tell the difference is, like, if that one had red eyes, avoid it. If this one doesn't, you know, it might be there to help you, which is pretty cool. They're usually associated with hell and death, which I feel like
that's
pretty
probably
obvious.
Why they get the bad rap and why people think they're always evil, just because death is scary and we think of death as being scary.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that everything associated with death has to be scary.
Exactly.
They can be puppies.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's why Hades has always been so interesting to me, is because he is the god of the underworld. He's associated with death, but he wasn't evil. He wasn't supposed to be evil.
Yeah.
Despite what Disney told you. Like, you know, he just, people respected him and were afraid of him, but
yeah,
he wasn't necessarily a bad guy. In fact, he was one of the only gods who, like, did his job and didn't step out of line too often, so.
And didn't treat all women like garbage. Yeah,
exactly.
And, you know, Zeus.
don't say it too loud. Well, like we were saying before, hellhounds actually turn up in pop culture a lot. They're really good fodder for something, you know, to throw in there, something scary, something to run away from. They were in Sherlock Holmes's The Hound of the Baskervilles. That was, you know, like a hellhound type creature. The Wheel of Time and Good Omens, another fantasy series that had hellhounds. And of course, TV shows like Supernatural, Buffy, and Teen Wolf had hellhounds, and they were all
Yeah.
very different, but kind of had a similar origin.
Right, yeah. Yeah. And similar, I would say similar motivations, like, you know, the Hellhound and Teen Wolf, he was kind of the one responsible for finding, you know, dead people and, like, bringing them to, like, kind of, like, collecting the dead kind of thing. Like, they're all peripherally associated with death and darkness. And
yeah. So, in Greek mythology, I did not find a ton of references to hellhounds in the general sense. Cerberus kept popping up, which was really interesting to me because I never really thought of Cerberus as a hellhound like I thought of hellhounds that we see, you know, like Mrs. O'Leary or hellhounds we see in, like, Supernatural and that sort of thing. Cerberus is the Hound of Hades, and he was the offspring of Echidna and Typhon. He had three heads, a serpent tail, and a mane of snakes. And that's not really how I picture hellhounds. You know, I picture them more like regular dogs, but as we saw, there can be various versions of it.
I was going to say, he's literally like a hellhound.
Yeah.
Like, he's the Hound of Hades. He's the hound that lives in the underworld. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily a hellhound, but the hellhound. Yeah. I think that's kind of, yeah.
I wonder if it's sort of like, I mean, I don't think we ever hear about Cerberus's offspring, but you know how, like, there's Pegasus, and then all Pegasi came from Pegasus?
Yeah.
I wonder if that could be
it's possible,
like that. I didn't read anything about that, but it would make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And Cerberus fills the role that other hellhounds fill as well, because he is associated with the underworld and with death. He guarded the underworld. He kept spirits in and the living out. So very much, you know, the same thing that we associate with the other hellhounds. And humans could get into the underworld if they were smart enough. One example of that is Orpheus playing him music and, you know, either putting him to sleep or distracting him, calming him down so that he could sneak by him.
I don't know if my brain never put together that that's why you play fluffy music.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow. Anyway, keep going. I'm just shocked at my own naivete.
As long as you figured it out eventually, it's okay. But yeah, I mean, that's obviously where that Fluffy and Harry Potter, like, comes from, that myth as well. And the other big thing with Cerberus is Hercules's 12th labor was bringing Cerberus to the mortal realm. That was, like, the last thing that he had to do in order to... Why was he even doing those labors? I don't remember. Was that to become a god?
I think so.
Now I have to Google it because...
I believe that, yes, he had the 12 labors were so that he could become immortal.
Oh, it says as part of his sentence.
Oh.
Oh, because he killed his wife and children, as you do, and...
When you're Greek.
Yeah. Let's see. When he awakened from his temporary insanity, Hercules was shocked and upset by what he'd done. He prayed to the god Apollo for guidance, and the god's oracle told him he would have to serve Eurystheus, the king of Tiryns and Mycenae, for 12 years in punishment for the murders. As part of his sentence, Hercules had to perform 12 labors, feats so difficult that they seemed impossible.
Dun, dun, dun. And now Percy has to do pretty much all of them.
Yeah. So,
one at a time.
So, but the hilarious thing to me about this in particular, and this was from Percy Jackson's Greek Heroes, so I don't know if it was exactly this easy in the original myth. I assume because that is meant to be representative of the original myths, but literally, Hades just let him take Cerberus up to the mortal realm, and then he was like, all right, thanks, you can go home now, and Cerberus just, you know, loped off back to the underworld. Like,
I just
wasn't
need to
exactly
borrow your puppy for a minute.
Yeah, it wasn't exactly difficult. Like, he went down to the underworld and asked Hades, and Hades was like, "Yeah, sure, why not?"
Knocked on the door and said, "Can I walk your pup?"
Yeah, exactly. He's driving me nuts. Go.
And Hades said, "Yep, go for it."
So really, in Greek mythology, that's like all I found on hellhounds.
Wow.
And I kind of expected them to be more prominent. But looking back, I guess I've never really heard of any stories about like general hellhounds, you know, wreaking havoc or anything. Kind of expected Hades to maybe have something to do with that, but he just had Cerberus.
Yeah. I like that they're not monsters.
Right.
Which, I mean, in the Percy Jackson world, we know that they're not. But, like, I like that
well,
they're not...
technically they are.
Well, that's true.
because Mrs. That's O'Leary right. is, she, like, yeah. the only nice one.
But, like, they're not technically monsters. I mean, there are bad ones, but there's bad and good humans, too. Right, so, exactly. like, I like that they're not really all just, like, these crazy, evil, monstrous creatures, you know, associated with death and all, yeah. It's, they're just creatures. They mm-hmm. happen to live in the underworld or happen to be involved in the, you know, matters of death or whatever, so they have a bit of a dark tone to their lives, mm-hmm. but they're not really, like, evil or anything, yeah. so that's cool.
That's why I liked looking at all the different myths across the world, because people interpret them similarly and differently at the same time, and it kind of just depends on where you're from and the situation you're in and what type you run up against. Like, it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I would like to do more research on it sometime. But let's get into hellhounds and Percy Jackson in particular. So in the Ultimate Guide, it says, huge dogs from hell with black fur, glowing red eyes, massive strength and speed, and the ability to appear and disappear at will. Almost all are unfriendly to demigods, with the exception of Mrs. O'Leary, pet to Quintus. She is bigger than a tank, has a bark slightly louder than an artillery gun, and can shadow travel. So again, you know, we get the black fur, the glowing red eyes, super fast, super strong, and they can shadow travel, which is pretty interesting. And also very useful, yes. And apparently all hellhounds are afraid of heights Aww. In Percy Jackson. So, I mean, if you're that big of a dog, I can't imagine you want to be up super high, because, like...
Well, yeah. And if you're used to being, like, underground...
Yeah, exactly.
Heights aren't going
that
to
That probably
be.
Makes more sense.
Plus, heights include Zeus and Zeus and Hades.
Yeah.
Don't exactly... You know, I can see how all of that kind of correlates. Like, yeah.
So we do see hellhounds in... I only went through Percy Jackson and the Olympians. Mrs. O'Leary is also in Heroes of Olympus a whole bunch. But in the first series, in The Lightning Thief, Percy is attacked during Capture the Flag. Chiron saves him with some arrows. Sea of Monsters, hellhounds are on the Princess Andromeda. Battle of the Labyrinth, Mrs. O'Leary is introduced. And in The Lightning Thief, Mrs. O'Leary is also around. And Kronos has a lot of hellhounds on his side, too. Which makes sense because he was living in Tartarus and, you know, all of that was going on. But the other cool thing is we also see hellhounds in the Arusha series and the Stormrunner series. So they're kind of everywhere in all sorts of myths. And I really liked that.
Very cool.
Yeah. I think this was the most succinct monster guide we've ever done. Like, I really was expecting there to be more.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's because Mrs. O'Leary is kind of super important and yeah. really easy to remember and just sticks out in your brain when you think about creatures from Percy Jackson. Like, you know, you think of Blackjack and you think of her and you think of, you know, but you don't necessarily, like, we don't actually get a ton of Mrs. O'Leary, especially, like, right away.
Right.
We met her, and she kind of was there at the beginning of this book, and we have not seen her since. It's been at least 8 chapters since we met her, and we haven't seen her again. So, like, it's, you know, she's around, but she's not central to the story yet, and we do find out that she's more instrumental to, like, the whole shadow right. travel thing, and she becomes more interesting later on. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, no, it's more hellhounds.
Yeah.
We like hellhounds.
Kind of like them. I mean, I know the other ones are meant to be scary, but Mrs. O'Leary is great.
I mean, if Rick ever does feel so moved to write another Greek book, he could just have someone with a pet hellhound who's yeah. not a son or child of Hades. Like,
right.
That could be an interesting dynamic. We can find out how they, you know, get their hellhound, but I that would be cool.
I agree. More puppies.
All the puppies.
Yes.
Fire puppies.
All right, I mean, that's it. Should that's we it. Jump right wrote. Into our chapters?
Yeah, sure, why not? Okay, so this week we are reading chapters 9 and 10 from Battle of the Labyrinth, and chapter 9 is entitled I Scoop Poop.
More poop.
Our favorite topic. Anyway, Here's our recap. Okay, so last week, we left Percy with a stable full of poop to clean and a deadline of sunset to save himself and all his friends from, well, basically death. Percy only agreed to take on this task because he remembered how Hercules did it, using the nearby river to clean the stables. He heads down to the water, but there's an uncooperative naiad there who makes some pretty appropriate points about polluting her waters and such. Percy makes the decision not to use the fresh water source, which pleases the naiad, softening her to his cause. She tells him the entire branch is built on a former seabed, showing him the shell remnants in the soil. Percy tosses a shell into the stables absentmindedly and hears water rush like it was escaping a water balloon or such. He realizes he can channel water from the seashell fragments. He starts sifting through the soil, and before long, he has a whole stable squeaky clean, and the flesh-eating horses are way more cooperative, begging Percy to keep the salt water away. Once clean, Percy dashes toward the house and arrives in time, but Geryon tries to slither out of their deal. Since Percy never made him swear on the River Styx, Geryon is not held to the terms of their agreement. Percy is furious and starts to fight. Geryon tells Eurytion to kill Percy, but the immortal demigod refuses. Geryon fights instead. Percy quickly realizes that he must strike all three of Geryon's hearts at once to kill him, so he says a quick prayer to Apollo and Artemis to guide his arrow, and then dives as Geryon lunges. Since Percy dives to Geryon's side, he looses the arrow, letting it impact Geryon under the arm, penetrating all three hearts on its way through his body. Ding dong, the monster's dead. Eurytion does not stop Percy from releasing his friends or offering a quick barbecue offering to Artemis and Apollo in thanks. Instead, he helps by answering all Percy's questions. Then Percy advises him to clean up the ranch a bit and stop selling to Titans. Eurytion agrees, which brings us to the Nico of it all. Nico is still pissed at Percy, but Percy puts a few pieces together very quickly now that he's looking at Nico in person for a second. Percy knows now who's been letting him in on Nico's moves. He knows it's Bianca that's been sending him Iris messages. Percy suggests they try to summon Bianca so she can hopefully tell Nico to stop trying to bring her back and accept that she's gone and out of reach. Whew. Okay, a chapter with one event. That's all I'm asking. Just one. One chapter where we go to a thing, we do the thing, and then the chapter ends, and I don't have to run 17 items through a thing. Like, Percy cleans the stables. Chapter. Yeah. Not Percy cleans the stables and then fights Geryon and then yells at Nico and then they move on. Like, there's so much stuff.
There is.
But that's why it's good, so
yeah. That is why it's good, yeah.
Let's start with the poop, I guess.
Yeah.
Start with the cleaning. So instead of using fresh water like Hercules, Percy finds a way to use seawater. And honestly, I just really, really loved how this whole sequence went together.
So did I.
With him being respectful of the naiad's legitimate concerns. Mm-hmm. Like, when Hercules did this, it screwed up my whole ecosystem. You know, living things died. It was destroyed and wrecked and gross and disgusting for many, many years. And I'm not letting you do it either. And, like, I totally get it. And I like that in the end, Percy was like, you know what? I'm not going to do it. I'm not using your water.
Yeah.
And, like, you could tell the naiad saw that he was being, like, legit. Like, mm-hmm. He was being authentic and was not just, like, having her on trying to manipulate her. Like, he was like, you know what? You're right. I'm not going to do it. And that just, it's so Percy. And I love it.
Yeah.
Like, he actually does take these words that are being said to him not just as an impediment to get what he wants. It's like, you know what? She has a point, and I should probably try and figure out a better way, which, crap, I'm trying to save my friends.
Yeah. I really love this, too. And it wasn't just because of the river and messing up the ecosystem, which obviously, as a son of Poseidon, he would be concerned about. But he almost immediately gave up on using the river. He was just like, I'm not going to fight this. I'm not going to argue. I'm not going to try to make her see my point, because her point is more important than mine. Even though my friends are in danger, like, I shouldn't hurt somebody to save somebody, which, again, very Percy.
Mm-hmm.
But what I really loved about this was he thought of himself as just some son of Poseidon being a bully. And he hated that. Like, he didn't want to be a bully. His reputation preceded him as a son of Poseidon, and he didn't want to be like his predecessors. And that is obviously something that plays into this whole series and what happens in the next book and the legacy that the gods have and all of that. And I just, Yeah, I really, really loved that.
Yeah. It's one of the reasons why Percy is such a great main character. Mm-hmm. You know, people tend to drift away from liking main characters after a while because they're a little bit predictable and they're the way that we connect to the story. So they ultimately start to feel very personal, like you have your own idea of who the main character is or whatever. But, like, Percy is kind of a different take on a main character. Mm-hmm. He does make the right decision more often than the selfish decision, which is where most main characters, I think, kind of lose the script and where people kind of, you know, get tired of... people got tired of, you know, Harry Potter in the fifth book when he's whining and pouting about everything, and we know now why he was doing that. Mm-hmm. But, like, when I read the fifth book the first time, I remember being like, okay, this is annoying. Like, he needs to stop being an annoying pain in my butt. Whereas with Percy, like, he really does kind of take a second and is like, you know what, I don't want this to be my story. Yeah. I'm gonna change it. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not gonna follow in the footsteps of, you know, Perseus and Theseus and all of the other yeses. Yeah.
Excellent. Excellent reference.
I knew you'd like that. but yeah, so it just made me smile and reminded me why I like Percy so much.
Yeah.
It's just a good dude. Anyway. Okay, so Percy uses these seashells. Once he kind of figures out how to do it, he realizes that, like, the salt water is, like, yay, I can use salt water, and he can actually, like, have some modicum of control over it, as opposed to the fresh water, which he probably could have had some control over, but he's you know, Poseidon's the god of the sea, so salt water is a little more his domain. So he uses it to clean the stables. The water gushes out of these little shells and power washes the whole thing, basically. And I love that the flesh-eating horses are all freaked out by the salt water, and they're like, no, don't bring us, don't bathe us in the salty, gross water again. And I just think,
yeah.
Considering they wanted to eat him. I mean.
Exactly. I have seen a lot of fans talking about how Percy is OP, how he's overpowered. And I'm starting to understand why. Because I feel like, even though this is not outside of his realm of ability, it's not like it's necessarily adding a new, like, gift or ability to his registrar. He just, like, the shells, like, bringing forth seawater from the shells, it's pretty cool power. So anytime you have a shell around, or if you keep a shell in your pocket, like, if you're in the middle of the desert, you can still bring forth water. It's not that I thought it was convenient, because he still had a problem to solve in terms of, like, okay, the water is right there, but I can't use it. I have to find another way. And it made sense with the history of the soil and everything like that. But out of everybody that we've seen, Percy has such a versatile arsenal of abilities. And we don't really see that with the other demigods as much. So it was just interesting to me.
I think I would agree if he used this ability over and over and over again down the line.
Yeah.
But he doesn't. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, not that I remember. We'll see if maybe he revisits it at some point. But, like, it's not like he, you know, sees it work here and then shoves his pocket full of seashells just in case. Like, he's happy to have the ability to get this task done and save his friends, and then he leaves. Mm-hmm. Like, if this specific power of channeling salt water from seashells became, like, a regular tool in his arsenal, then I think I would agree with you that it's overpowered. But I think since he is literally just like, okay, this is how I can get this done, and then it basically falls to the wayside, it makes me feel like it's a little more under control.
Yeah. I mean, I still think that he has a wider range of abilities than most of the other demigods, which makes it feel a little OP, but at the same time, his power is water, and how much of the earth is made up of water, it makes sense that he has all of these different ways to control it.
Yeah.
And different, you know, like the navigation and everything tied to water. Water is so vital to our lives and covers so much of the earth that, like, I'd be surprised if he couldn't do all of these things.
Right. Yeah. I think the most out there of his abilities is the horse talking thing.
That one's, like, different.
Which is just specifically related to Poseidon. So, like,
right.
That one I could kind of see. But yeah, you're right. Like, with water making up so much of our bodies and the earth and all of that, it's, you know, it's vital and it's everywhere.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I can kind of, yeah, I'm with you. Percy kind of loses control a little bit, and is, like, has a moment where he's not sure if he's going to be able to stop the water. And I just thought it was interesting and worth noting that he's still, even in book four, still trying to figure out how exactly he controls all of this. Like, he's learned a bit here and there, but he still is not a demigod who knows what he can do. He's still figuring it out. And
plus, it'd be too easy if he was perfect at everything right from the beginning. So,
oh, yeah. Agreed.
I liked this, too.
Yeah. But just something worth noting, like, he's still figuring it out, which I liked. Okay, so he cleans the stable, he heads to the house, and he's telling Geryon, here we go. I did it. It's clean. You can go check on it. Everything's cool. I want my friends. Let's go. And Geryon's like, you didn't make me swear on the River Styx, so nope. No deal. Haha. I'm going to turn him in anyway. I want to get paid.
Yeah.
I mean,
basically.
Yeah. I'm not shocked. I mean, you'd have to be an idiot to be shocked. A monster broke his deal? What? No. But it also just is not, it's not cool. Like, they made a deal, and, you know, I think Geryon got the better end of the deal. That was a really gross project that needed to be handled, and it just, yeah, it's not cool.
I liked the fight scene, at least. Like, that was fun for me. I thought it was really interesting that he couldn't be killed in a very easy way because he had three hearts. I think, you know, him throwing, like, the barbecue knives and fork and stuff at Percy was pretty funny. And Percy was really smart to come up with that way to kill Geryon. And it reminded me of how Odysseus shot the arrows through the axes to win his wife's hand back, and just, I don't think it was meant to be, like, a parallel necessarily, but it just reminded me of that,
yeah.
And I thought it was kind of, anything that reminds me of the original Greek myths, even if it's kind of offhand, just tells you how steeped in the mythology this series is, and how much Rick has done his research to make it, you know, as authentic as possible.
Yeah, definitely. During this fight, I think it's actually maybe, like, right at the end there. Geryon mentions that someone tells him Percy's a bad shot. He says something to the effect of, like, they said you couldn't shoot, you know. And, like, who is they? There's this mysterious they who keeps giving people information and who apparently paid their way through the maze, and we still don't know who that was. And
I assume it's Luke, because Luke would know if he was a bad shot.
Well, we also know from the previous chapter that Quintus is involved in Triple G Ranch.
Right.
And we don't know his affiliation yet, so maybe he paid their way through. Maybe he's the one who told Geryon, like, he's not a great shot. We don't know. We don't know why he would tell him that. That sort of thing. But there's definitely somebody running around pulling some strings that we don't know who it is. And it just is another little nugget of mystery that we still have to figure out.
Yeah.
The next item on my happy hit parade is Eurytion's refusal to follow Geryon's orders.
Yeah.
Which, yes.
I knew, because I liked him for a reason.
I liked the old cowboy giant dude.
Yeah.
Like, I thought he seemed like a decent human when we... human-ish, when we met him last chapter. And, like, I'm really glad to see that here. He just straight up refuses to kill Percy, and Geryon, of course, is, like, pissed. And then once Geryon is dead, Eurytion is like, well, we're gonna do things a little differently around here. And I like that he hears, I think it's Annabeth's suggestions for how to clean up the Triple G Ranch. It's either Annabeth or Percy.
I think it was Percy.
Was it? Okay.
Yeah.
Like, he listens to their suggestions, you know, stop sacrificing sacred animals, stop selling to the Titans, you know, keep things clean, find your own path.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, you know what? Yeah. And I think Annabeth is the one who says, maybe Geryon will be working for you when he comes back. And Eurytion is like, I like that.
Yeah.
I like that idea.
He just wanted to hang out with his dog. You know, he didn't want anything to do with this. It was all Geryon. And he doesn't fight. He doesn't protest. Like, he's totally fine following a better path. And I think it's because he was a demigod at some point. So he was human, and he got immortality and then was tied to Geryon, unfortunately, and has died for Geryon. And that was, like, a whole thing. But ultimately, like, he was a hero, and he hasn't really lost sight of that necessarily. He was just kind of put in a bad circumstance. But
it does make me a little sad that we don't see more of Eurytion, like, later on in the series.
Yeah.
Like, I would have loved him.
He's a very interesting, and I think there's a really interesting parallel because we know what decision Percy faces at the end of this series, the fact that Eurytion took that deal.
Yeah.
And Percy didn't is very telling. And I wonder if Percy will think of him when he comes up against that.
Yeah. No. I like this dude. Okay. So the last little event in this chapter is Nico. After the fight, after all of it, Annabeth and Percy are like, so Nico, what are you going to do? You can come with us. And then I forget who recommends it, but they say, like, you can also stay here. And Eurytion says, like, yeah, he'll be safe here. You know, we're going to do some work, but he can hang out and we'll, you know, he'll be fine. And ultimately, Nico decides to stay with Eurytion rather than go with them. Mostly, I think, because he just still can't get over his anger with Percy.
Yeah.
But while they're still figuring all of that out, Nico's pissed about Bianca, so they're going to summon Bianca. Mm-hmm. That's the whole thing, is that Percy kind of puts together some pieces and says, well, yeah, I think she'll show up for me, and Nico's like all pissy about it.
Yeah. I completely forgot about this because Bianca has been sending Percy the iris messages.
Right.
And I literally out loud said, what? When I read that, because I was so shocked. I did not think that it was her.
I completely forgot about this too. Yeah. So when he's like, I know who's sending them, I was like, wait, you do? And then he's like, it's Bianca. And I'm like, oh yeah. Oh, that's good. That's really good.
Yeah. Nice job, Rick. And it's well written. Not only did he keep that secret, you know, like, I really didn't figure it out at all, but it's such a good twist in terms of Bianca being the one to want to help Nico, to try to get these two to be friends again. Like, she understands the whole situation. She knows what Nico's trying to do and doesn't agree with it. And she's staying away from Nico. We learn this later. She's staying away from Nico in order to get him to stop, mm-hmm, and knows that he's not going to stop. So she tries to bring Percy in to help with that. And it was great. It was a great end to the chapter.
And like, she has very limited abilities, but one thing she can do is let Percy see what Nico's doing.
Right.
And like, that's so smart and it's so cool. Like, yeah, she can send an iris message and let Percy witness for himself what Nico's up to, mm-hmm, so that he can hopefully help him. And that's, yeah. Bianca being a good sister, even from beyond the grave. Okay, so that wraps up this chapter. Let's do our favorite quotes and favorite moments. I'm going to start with my favorite quote. Annabeth says, get the animals on your side and they'll help you. Once Geryon gets back, maybe he'll be working for you this time. And Eurytion grins and says, now that I could live with. And I just loved, again, I love that whole thing. And
yeah,
Eurytion kind of being like, yeah, you know, maybe I can make some changes here. And I might be tied to this jerk face, but at least, you know, for the next 100 years or so, I'm going to have the place all to myself.
Triple G, because he has 3 chests.
Yeah.
I did. Real time, just figured that out.
I'm having Harry Potter epiphanies. You're seeing the triple G of it all.
Sorry.
Prophecy Radio, ladies and gents.
We're not always smart, but we get there eventually.
We put it together. We get there.
Oh my god. Oh.
That was classic.
Wow.
But yeah, so Karen, what was your favorite quote?
Mine was actually from Eurytion when, I think it was him, I'm pretty sure it was him. He goes,
it was.
Yeah. He goes, I hope the dead like root beer. And I just, I don't know. It was funny.
Because I think he says, like, you can go fetch my cooler.
Yeah.
And then he's like, I really hope the dead like
root beer. Yeah, he calls him Cyclops Boy, which I did not like.
He doesn't know his name.
But.
And he's clearly a Cyclops.
Yeah, that is true.
I don't think he meant it maliciously. He doesn't come across as that kind of old giant cowboy. Anyway. Okay, so then our favorite moments as well. Mine was Percy admitting defeat and promising the Naiad not to use the river. It was brilliant, and Percy was just following his gut and doing what felt right, and mm-hmm, I just loved that it worked out in his favor.
Yeah.
And what was yours?
Eurytion being chill, mostly, and Percy telling him to take care of the animals. I thought it was really sweet. And I liked that Eurytion was a good guy.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed. Okay, so the next chapter is chapter 10, entitled We Play the Game Show of Death. just promising. Okay, so we start this chapter summoning Bianca so Nico can talk to her and Percy can prove that he wasn't responsible for Bianca's death just because he was there. Many other spirits try to come forward, and Minos does steal a bit of the food from the sacrifice made to bring Bianca forward, but Percy and Annabeth keep them at bay until Bianca makes her appearance. Once she arrives, she shooes the rest of the spirits away, leaving her with her brother and friends for a few moments. Percy apologizes for his role in her death. Bianca reminds him it was her choice, not his. She then remarks on Nico's height and the amount of time that has passed. Percy was right. Bianca was sending the iris messages, which is one mystery solved. Nico yells at his sister, angry at her for dying and taking it out on Percy. We learn that, for children of Hades, grudge-keeping is their fatal flaw. So just another fatal flaw we can keep track of. Good to know. Bianca leaves them with a warning that Cronus is kind of onto them with all this magic that Nico's using, and they should be careful. They spend the night in the house and leave the next day, but not without Percy having a vivid dream of the palace on top of Mount Tam. It's looking much better now. All the furnishings are starting to come into clearer view and are looking a little nicer. Luke is there with a host of monsters, but also Kelly the Empusei and Camp, who we met a chapter ago. They're waiting for the right time to attack. Kelly slashes through that dream and sends Percy on to another, where he sees Daedalus tricking and killing his nephew because the young boy wanted nothing but to learn. Daedalus gets especially cross when it's suggested that Perdix, his nephew, wants to continue his work after the old man dies. He tricks Perdix into falling to his death, and Percy wakes up suddenly the next day. Sleeping is hard, so Percy has a quick talk with Grover. A week has passed since they left, which leaves Grover with a bad situation awaiting him with the council. They all get a little rest, and they're finally headed back to the maze. Eurytion offers Nico a place to rest and think on the farm, and then also passes Annabeth away to get to Hephaestus's forge. The silver disc he hands her to push like a button sends them scuttling after a little spider. Annabeth's having a great time with this, let me tell you. They come upon a sphinx, and Annabeth volunteers to answer the riddles, assuming they will be the same questions from lore. But this sphinx is more interested in random bits of general knowledge. Annabeth refuses to go forward if she realizes there aren't going to be any actual riddles, which sends the sphinx on the rampage. Percy suggests Annabeth go invisible to even the playing field a bit, and she listens. They are able to escape by the skin of their teeth, leaving the sphinx behind and listening as she roars.
Okay. Again, several things. Yeah. Like, I feel like the Bianca stuff could have been a chapter, and then the sphinx could have been a chapter. I mean, I'm glad they're one chapter, because, like, it does keep the story moving.
Agreed.
But
it's just a lot.
It is a lot.
So, yeah, we'll dive right in here with Bianca. Mm-hmm. We kind of talked about this at the end of the last chapter, because it kind of just is all one event that kind of overlaps. But I liked Bianca's attitude here, honestly. Mm-hmm. Do I wish that maybe she was a little warmer toward Nico? Yes, but I get why she's not.
Yeah.
She's trying to push him away and get him to stop mm-hmm. trying to bring her back.
Because what he's doing is very dangerous, and Cronus is probably already aware of him, but if he knew how strong Nico was, that could be very, very bad for Nico and for everybody else.
So. Well, and how easily could he be manipulated with promises of how to bring Bianca back and all of that? Yeah. Like, she can see that there's mm-hmm. a clear path where Cronus can use Nico and she just doesn't want
I mean, Minos is already doing that to him. And, exactly. We also find out that Minos is the one who's been driving people mad in the labyrinth, which I thought was pretty interesting.
Yeah. Little punk.
Right. That's not the word you wanted to say.
No, it's not. But he is a punk.
Yeah.
I
also thought, kind of rolling back just a little bit, when Bianca first emerges from the trees, she's brighter than the other spirits, and the other spirits kind of pay deference to her. I assume because she's a daughter of Hades, like, she has a little bit more dominion over them, even as a spirit, but I thought that was kind of a cool little, like, detail.
Funny enough, I originally thought it was because she was so newly dead.
Oh,
that her spirit maybe she was stronger, and that the only reason they really listened to her is because she was stronger. So, like, she had the ability to kind of say, like, this is for me, not for you, go. But you're right. Like, as a daughter of Hades, I can see why spirits might listen when she mm-hmm. says, you know, disperse. I'm the one they're looking for.
Right. And speaking of Hades' children, fatal flaw is holding grudges, and that's when she tells Nico that he has to forgive Percy, and he really doesn't want to, and I think he's still very angry in that moment. We see a little bit later that it's, I mean, he's still very hurt, but I think he's kind of coming around to the idea, but Nico is a very stubborn little boy.
So we're slowly but surely, we're kind of ticking off all the fatal flaws. We're learning people's, you know, Percy's, we learned in this book, is, you know, we already knew Annabeth's and daughters of Athena and what theirs tend to be. So, yeah, it's just interesting kind of getting an idea that most children of Hades have a problem with grudges.
Yeah.
I mean, I get it. I guess I get it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, Bianca ultimately leaves Nico wanting more time with his sister, but she says, like, stop summoning me. It's not good for you. Cronus is on to you. He can feel the magic being used. Like, you don't want this. And Nico's not happy, but she's gone, and that it is what it is. I guess the next thing, really, because we don't really have major closure on that, but, right. Like, you know, Nico's going to stay behind. They're all going to go back into the labyrinth, so, like, we kind of have to move on. And they decide to stay the night at the ranch and get some sleep. And Percy has a little trouble at first, but once he finally does sleep, he has two dreams.
Right. And I'm counting this as prophecy count number 20. Okay. I think it's one because it's one within one.
Yeah.
It's like an inception thing.
Yeah.
So it's still just 20.
That's totally fine with me.
Okay.
I let you do the prophecy count because I couldn't... Yeah. No. I'm bad at keeping track of it.
Oh, yeah. I usually have to go back in every single, like, doc and see which one we left off on.
What was the last one?
Yeah.
Percy gets a vision of Mount Tam, and he sees that, like, it's got better furnishings and it's stronger. It's just more of a solid place now, as opposed to what it was when they were there last year. So that's not good.
Yeah, it's not good at all.
Basically means Cronus is gaining strength and all of that jazz, and we don't want that. He kind of gets a good look at Luke and at the Empusa, and Camp is now there as well. I don't think anything like super major happens, but he just basically gets an idea that like things are not looking good for him. They're looking better for Luke.
Yeah. The thing that jumped out to me was that Luke told Camp she could carry Ariadne's string, which was like a huge honor. And that made me ask, do they already have the string?
I don't know.
Or because were they still going to find it, and when they find it, she could have it?
I can't remember. Like, he made it sound like they already had it.
Yeah, it kind of did.
I didn't think they had it either, so yeah, I'm a little confused there.
We'll have to see about that.
As things go forward, we'll see what happens. And then the second dream was Daedalus. Percy kind of falls into a time when Daedalus is older, and Perdix, Athena's... It didn't say it was Athena's offspring, but he was blessed by Athena.
Right, that's what I was wondering, too, because it was Daedalus's nephew, so there's a lineage there from Athena, but I guess, like, the lineage plus being blessed, probably because he was already predisposed to being very intelligent, like, she probably was like, yes, I like you.
But Perdix is just there to, like, learn from Daedalus and is really excited and starts talking about taking over for Daedalus when he dies, and Daedalus is not all about that life. And he tricks him with a beetle and chucks it off the edge and says, catch! And Perdix reaches too far and falls. And Daedalus has a moment where Perdix is hanging on to the side and he could have changed his mind, but he doesn't.
Yeah.
And he lets Perdix fall, and Athena says, like, you're gonna pay for that.
Yeah. And we don't really know how, other than, like, the burning around his throat, like, if he died right then and there or what happened, but...
The way Athena was talking, it sounded like she was gonna make him suffer for doing this, so I don't think he died then and there. But we don't know. Because, Percy has this burning feeling around his throat, and then he comes back, he wakes up. Mm-hmm. So we don't really know what happened to Daedalus there.
I'm curious how much of Daedalus's reaction to Perdix was depression over the loss of his son, craziness for working on all of this stuff for so many years. I mean, he was still very active and intelligent, but you can tell he was, like, a little bit off, and I'm curious, like, I don't want to give him excuses, because he murdered a boy, like, he murdered his own flesh and blood, and that is terrible and tragic, but I'm curious how much of his right mind he was or wasn't in.
Yeah, spending all that time alone in the labyrinth, like, I'm sure it had a toll, so,
Yeah.
It, again, not excusable. We do not excuse murder. But, you know, it's also worth weighing, like, what Daedalus' mental state was there. Right. And how he got to this point. Mm-hmm. But, yeah.
The other thing about this, real quick, that I found interesting was Kelly specifically said as they were moving into this vision that she is bringing despair to their eavesdropping enemies through these visions of Daedalus, I think.
Yeah.
So she's the one giving Percy these dreams, and it's supposed to, like, mentally affect him or something like that. I mean, he does wake up, like, clutching his throat, yeah. And even the other times.
I'm curious if she thinks that seeing Daedalus do all of this stuff is going to make them not want to find Daedalus.
Maybe.
Because they think he's evil or something. Versus, yeah, that it's definitely interesting. Yeah, Kelly thinks she's got one over on them, but not quite sure yet.
Mm-hmm.
See how this plays out later. So, other than that, Percy wakes up, and they basically say goodbye to Eurytion.
Which, sorry, I just wanted to say really quick, I thought he was really interesting because he's a son of Ares, but he doesn't act like most of the other sons of Ares or, you know, children of Ares. And I just wonder why he's not like most of the other children. Is it because he's been around for so long? Is it because he's been tied to Geryon that he's kind of, like, seen, you know, people who are worse than anything he could imagine, and he's kind of grown because of that? Instead of going darker, he went lighter, that sort of thing. And it just kind of reminded me of Slytherins and how in the Harry Potter books, there really aren't any Slytherins that are, like, good. Like, there are some who I think are a little bit grayer. You could argue that for Draco. Like, he
Slughorn.
Doesn't... Yeah, I mean, that's true. Slughorn's kind of sleazy, but he's not necessarily, like, a bad guy.
He's ambitious, but he's not
evil. I guess what I wanted to say was, I don't feel like J.K.R. did a very good job of making Slytherins a complex group of people versus Rick, who has made Children of Ares very complex. Because even though Clarice is Percy's enemy for several books, we still like her. We're still kind of rooting for her. We still understand that she's on the same side that Percy's on. And there are, you know, Ares is a jerk, and there are other children from all over the gods that are good and bad. Like, I just think he did a better job of making them way more three-dimensional.
Well, and with Luke being a son of Hermes, you would assume that Luke would be the child of Ares based on how things are set up.
Yeah.
But he's not, and he's actually the biggest hurdle other than mm-hmm. Kronos.
Although Hermes is the trickster god, so
right.
That does but make like, sense a little bit.
But, like, it's not, yeah, it's not as cut and dry,
right.
I think. Rick definitely did a good job with, like, weaving different gods' strengths and weaknesses into characters. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you've got Clarice's, you know, strength and ability to be a good warrior and to fight for people that she cares about, but she also does have some of Ares, like, quick temper and all that. So, like, she is a perfect blend of strength and weakness mm-hmm. of Ares. So,
yeah. Each character is their own person. Imagine that, you know? Like, he's a good writer. He did his job.
Exactly. Okay, so, yeah, they leave Eurytion and the... you know, say goodbye, and Nico stays, and he basically just says, yeah, I'm gonna fix the place up, I'm gonna stop with the sacred animals, and
he's going veg.
I'm kicking these titans to the curb, I don't care about them.
Soybean patties.
Right, soybean patties. Oh, yeah. So, they enter the maze, mm-hmm. and pretty quickly...
I was going to say, following the spider thing,
yes.
And all I could think of was, why couldn't it be follow the butterflies?
I mean, it's true.
I would have bet money you were going to make that joke.
I mean, maybe. I might have gotten there. Yeah, but Animus is a little freaked out, but it scuttles off into the maze, so they mm-hmm. have to hurry, and they run after it. They only are able to follow it because Grover and Tyson can hear it, thanks goodness for their... superhuman hearing, and they follow it and pretty quickly come across this Sphinx.
Yeah.
Who is hosting her own game show.
Yeah.
Woohoo! But instead of these really complex riddles that must be puzzled out, she's basically asking general knowledge questions.
This was so funny to me because you can feel the teacher coming out of Rick here because she's basically offering Annabeth a standardized test.
Yes.
Where you don't need any actual intelligence. You just need the ability to memorize information. And Annabeth is pissed. Mm-hmm. She is so mad. And I really could tell, like, you can tell Rick used to be a teacher. He probably doesn't like standardized testing because it doesn't teach people things. It teaches them to memorize things.
It's not a measure of how much you learned. It's a measure right. of how much you memorized.
Yeah, exactly. And this was so funny to me.
Oh, yeah. It definitely shows, that's for sure. But yeah, Annabeth gets pissed and says, she just flat out refuses to finish.
Yeah.
She's answered 3 questions, I think, and the Sphinx is like, well, then I'm gonna eat you. And Annabeth's like, no, you're not. Like, this is garbage. You used to ask real questions that would challenge my intelligence, and that's what I thought I was getting here. Mm-hmm. Instead, you give me this garbage. Like, no. And I love that in the fight that ensues, they smash her grading machine.
Yeah.
And she gets so mad.
She has to do it by hand.
Like, no, now I have to score all of these by hand, you evil children. But yeah, so Percy is using his little noggin, and he realizes that the Sphinx is after Annabeth, not anybody else, really. Mm-hmm. She keeps lunging to Annabeth. So he says, go invisible and let us fight her. And Annabeth at first is like, no, like, it's my battle. But she's like, listen, this is the smartest way. So she does, she puts on her cap, goes invisible. They're able to fight her enough so they can escape. Annabeth slips out at the last possible second, and they're on their way back into the maze to continue on, hopefully following the spider, although we don't know. It kind of, like, scuttles around our statue at the beginning of the scene. And we don't know for sure if they can still follow it, but, you know, we'll get there.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where the chapter ends.
Yeah. Lots of stuff happened.
So much stuff. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So, let's do our favorite quotes, and I'm gonna let Karen go first this time.
It was when the Sphinx's ribbon on her chest that says, this monster has been rated exemplary, and it just, again, made me laugh.
I do like stickers.
Yeah.
I did like getting stickers in school.
Oh, yeah.
It made me happy. Okay, mine was, the maze is my property, not Daedalus's. Those who intrude deserve madness. And I just...
Minos.
I know, Minos is, he's such a problem. But I really loved just the idea of, like, him taking ownership of the maze and, like, just, yeah.
Which is so funny, because Daedalus is the one who created it, but Minos, like, owned it. Like, he commissioned it, I guess.
Yeah.
That does not give you ownership.
He was a king,
ownership.
So he believes everything is his. Yeah,
Has such an ego.
Such a garbage. Anyway, but yeah. So our favorite moments. What was yours?
Mine was Annabeth wanting a challenge from the Sphinx, even though it to fail means death. Because one, I really did like that the Sphinx. We didn't get the usual Sphinx riddle that, like, everybody knows at this point. So I was like, okay, cool, it's something different. And her just being mad, and, like, yeah, it is pride, it is her hubris coming out to play. But also, just the fact that, like, she has that flaw is kind of funny to me, that she was like, no, I want a real challenge. I don't care if there's a chance that I might die. Like, don't insult my intelligence.
Yeah. Love it, love it, love it. Yeah, mine was Eurytion kind of being stuck, but being ready to make changes now that Geryon's going to be gone for a bit. And I just liked seeing him have a bright future for the next 100 years, hopefully. Okay, so that wraps up our chapters for this week. Make sure to read chapters 11 and 12 for next week.
We're halfway through the book.
Woohoo!
Yeah.
Book halfway through celebration. Yeah, do a little dance. Okay. Dancing down. No, that's exciting.
It is exciting.
It's going fast. Some of these chapters are very long.
Yeah.
But
it's exciting. There's a lot of stuff happening.
Yeah.
The Labyrinth is a really cool thing.
Yeah. Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. Follow our website on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and Instagram at Subjectify Media, or visit us at SubjectifyMedia.com. We are home to 3 other podcasts, including Rewatchable, where we rewatch canceled and cult classic shows, Not About the Weather, which is a general interest show that sometimes features interviews with creators, and Not Another Teen Wolf podcast, which was recently revived thanks to the upcoming Teen Wolf movie. You can contact Prophecy Radio directly on Twitter at Prophecy Podcast or on Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr at Prophecy Radio Podcast. You can email us your long-form thoughts to prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. find us on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms. We really hope that you will consider leaving us a review or a rating. 5-star reviews really help others to find us, and that would be a huge help. Leave us questions and comments or ideas for any content you might want to see in any of these places. We love hearing from you guys, so we look forward to that. Next week, we're going to watch Disney's Hercules, yay! Which I know Karen's really excited about. And we're just going to kind of look at Hercules and his presence in, like, the Disney movie versus in Percy versus...
Very different.
The myth, too, like, the general myth, too. So we're gonna give Hercules a minute and see what pop culture's had to say about him.
And I get to watch my favorite Disney movie of all time.
Yeah, she does. She's excited. So, yeah. But until then... This is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio signing off. Over and out.